This is Maine's Political Pulse. I'm Erwin Gratz with Maine Public's Chief Political Correspondent Steve Missler and Senior Political Reporter Mal Leary. Maine state primary is Tuesday. For lots of Mainers, it'll just be another ordinary day, thanks to the fact they've sent in their absentee ballots. Those who do go to the polls will be part of a practice run for a November election, likely still affected by the pandemic. There are a couple of key contested races to be decided Tuesday. Steve Missler, one of them is the Democratic Senate race.
And it's a race we've talked about quite a bit over the past year. That hasn't been the case in the national press, which seems to have bought the idea that House Speaker Sarah Gideon either doesn't have a primary or any opponents, or that she's just a lock to win it and it doesn't matter. But Gideon, who won the early endorsement of Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer and aligned liberal interest groups, does have a race to win on Tuesday, and it's against Betsy Sweet, a longtime lobbyist here at the State House, and Bree Kidman, an attorney from Saco. Now, Gideon has a lot of the high-profile endorsements and a ton of campaign money, but Betsy has recently proven that she shouldn't be counted out. She finished third in the 2018 gubernatorial primary, which, like this primary, had ranked choice voting, and that means if she and Bree Kidman can garner enough support on Tuesday, they could force the contest into a ranked choice runoff. And that would certainly be a blow to Gideon, even if she eventually prevails. And I'd add that the Republican operatives working on behalf of Senator Susan Collins are working very hard to have an impact in the primary. I've seen some attacks against Gideon that I didn't expect to see until the general election, but Republicans are deploying those now because they really want to weaken her standing among Democratic primary voters. And if you recall, Erwin, way back when this race started over a year ago, the Republicans were trying to influence the primary then when the National Republican Senatorial Committee bought these mobile billboards that were driving around in Portland and Freeport that were basically designed to elevate Betsy Sweet's profile. So not only will we find out next week who is challenging Susan Collins in November, but we'll find out whether Republicans are having any success in defining Gideon, who is well known here at the State House, but not so much, I think, in other parts of the state.
Mal, anything to add?
Republicans, particularly at the national level, are well known for trying to look down the road on elections and not just look at the immediate contest. And that's what we're seeing. They would really love to have a left progressive like Betsy Sweet to go up against Collins rather than Sarah Gideon.
How would that change the race if the challenge to Susan Collins comes from farther on the left?
Well, I think it gives more room for Collins to appeal to the moderate voters in the middle. That has always been the group that decides Maine elections. So, you know, there's method to their madness in the sense that they're spending millions of dollars attacking Sarah Gideon now. And we'll see those same ads if Sarah Gideon gets the nomination, because that's where they think she's vulnerable on some of these ethical issues.
Did we learn anything from the Maine public debate between these candidates?
I think the debate showed some differences in the three candidates' policy positions, but in terms of generating a robust discussion about those differences, it was a bit subdued. And part of the reason is that Gideon largely ignored questions or critiques from both Betsy Sweet and Bree Kidman about fundraising tactics or skipping debates and so forth. And even when Gideon had the opportunity to question either Kidman or Sweet, she pretty much gave them softball questions that were designed to shift the crosshairs to the big prize, Susan Collins. If Gideon is as far ahead as some of the polling would suggest, then it's probably a smart move to be that way, because frontrunners typically don't punch down unless someone has gotten under their skin, you know?
Right from the get-go, she has focused on Collins. She has not given any sort of attention to her Democratic opponents. She just barreled ahead, and I think that is a good strategy if indeed she can maintain the kind of lead that we've seen in the only public polling so far, which is a pretty substantial lead.
We were talking before about how the Republicans have been trying to kind of insinuate themselves into this race, the Democratic race. But what has Collins and her campaign been doing so far during this period to simply bolster her image in advance of the campaign?
What they've done is they've got a group of ads talking about the things she has done, for example, on the Diabetes Council. Time after time, again, we've seen those kind of positive ads. We've had the ads from Maine people saying that she's helped them solve issues and problems that they've had locally. So we've got that trend. At the same time, we've got the trend of the attack ads against Gideon. She hasn't forgotten, I should say, the fall, but she's kind of taken some of that huge amount of money and put it on attacking Gideon. We should also, of course, mention the amount of outside money that's coming in here. So there are some times when she doesn't have to worry about writing positive ads because the Chamber of Commerce is running them for her.
She's really keeping a safe distance from President Donald Trump. And that's probably a smart move, given that there are polls showing that the president is becoming a real drag on congressional candidates up for re-election this year, Republican Senate candidates in particular. I mean, there was a piece in the Washington Post this week that showed how ads run by Republican Senate candidates in some of these swing states like Maine make nary a mention of the president. You know, they're focusing on other things. Now, those candidates like Collins really have to walk a fine line here with the president. National Republican strategists have basically advised candidates, Republican candidates, to keep their distance from Trump, but not so far that they'll tick off the president's supporters. And I think that's Collins' approach so far. And we can expect to see more of that even after the primary, especially if the president's approval numbers continue to sag. The other thing she's doing is what Mal just pointed out, which is just highlighting what she's doing in Congress in terms of helping Maine obtain its share of pandemic relief and other initiatives, and contrasting that with Gideon in particular, because the Maine legislature has not been in session since mid-March.
The other major contested primary is for the Republican nomination in the 2nd Congressional District. So, Steve, how has that race been shaping up?
Yeah. Well, you know, after watching our debate with the three Republican candidates this week, I thought back to a tweet and photo that Eric Brakey posted back in October, and it was of the three candidates, Brakey, Adrian Bennett, and Dale Crafts, at a bowling alley together. Lots of smiles and good times. That was not what we saw this week, and with not what we're seeing on social media and not what we're seeing in the ads. At this point, I'm not sure these three candidates would get together for a socially distanced card game. That's how nasty the primary has become. And just over the past few weeks, really, in an hour debate, I mean, Brakey accused Bennett's campaign of asking him to smear Crafts during the debate, and also what he described as disgusting personal attacks against him. Bennett, who seemed to be working with Crafts at one point to go after Brakey as recently as last week, started attacking Crafts over his position to the CMP corridor project, and Crafts has hit back on Twitter calling her attacks desperate. But Erwin, I think all of this fighting really signals that this is a tight race and nobody really knows who's winning it. And that may include the candidate campaigns themselves, because there hasn't been a lot of independent polling. The polling that we have seen has been all over the place. And the candidates, typically they would do their own polling, but none of these three contenders here have a ton of money. So that's really limited what they can spend. You want to be able to know what to run on and where you are in the horse race. But none of these candidates have a ton of cash, and that's left them a bit in the dark about what's going to happen on Tuesday. Of the two congressional primaries that are up on Tuesday, I think this probably has the best chance of going to a runoff.
I think it's almost destined to go to a runoff when you look at what numbers are out there publicly. I just don't see any of them getting 50% plus one in this first round. Could be wrong, of course, but it certainly doesn't look that way now.
The winner, of course, will get to go up against Democrat Jared Golden in the fall. Golden won the seat in 2018. Now, traditionally, the first re-election campaign is the most risky for a U.S. House incumbent. So what has Golden been doing to try to get over this hump?
Yeah, I think Golden's campaign in some ways is a little bit like Susan Collins's, in the sense that he's avoiding a lot of entanglements with the president. And that's because the district he represents voted overwhelmingly for Trump in 2016. Now, we've seen some polling to indicate that that might not happen this year. And that would, frankly, be very good news for Golden, who has to balance between not angering voters who may like the president and also not angering liberal activists and voters that he'll need to help him turn out the Democratic vote in November. Those activists are highly motivated by their dislike of the president. There's no question about that. So it's harder, I think, for them to work for a candidate who isn't publicly sharing their disdain of Trump. But for Golden, I think the best thing that can happen is that the president's numbers continue to sag, which would give him more license to be critical of Trump and keep the support of Democratic voters. Golden is also highlighting support for anti-corruption and campaign finance bills. And I think, you know, those type of proposals generally are supported by a wide swath of voters, regardless of partisan affiliation. So he's trying to, you know, again, walk that fine line, and we'll see if he's successful.
He also is in a far different campaign than he was 2 years ago. There are no independents in this race. So it's going to be an up and down choice between Jared Golden and the Republican nominee. That gives him more flexibility on where he goes on some issues than he would if he had to worry about ranked choice voting as he did 2 years ago. It worked to his advantage 2 years ago. There's no guarantee it would work to his advantage this time, depending on who those independents would be. Fortunately for him, he has no independent candidates running, which, to fall back on the Senate race for a moment, we do have two independents that qualified there, and they're going to have an impact in terms of ranked choice voting.
So, Steve, do we have a new snapshot of the presidential race in Maine?
We do. The Cook Political Report released its electoral college rankings this week. It shows Maine moving from lean Democrat to likely Democrat statewide, and the second congressional district moving from likely Republican to lean Republican. What's important to remember here is that Maine and Nebraska are the only two states that award electoral votes based on winners of the statewide vote and by congressional district. That's why President Trump was able to get one electoral vote in 2016 while losing the statewide vote to Hillary Clinton. So the rating forecasts does seem like good news for Golden, at least for now. And so does this from analyst Amy Walter, who wrote that Republican strategists that she has spoken to think Trump is close to a point of no return, or what she described as his Katrina moment, which is basically a permanent loss of trust and faith among the majority of voters. And Amy also wrote that strategists on both sides this week said it's clear that Trump is dragging Republican congressional candidates with him as well. Now, if that trend continues, that really raises some questions about the Trump fealty campaigns that Golden's Republican challengers have been running up until this point. If the president continues to sag, then those Republican challengers against Golden may have to try to pivot a little bit away from the president in order to be successful, if in fact second congressional district is leaning a little bit more left than it did 4 years ago.
Let's bring it a little closer to home. Legislative leaders of both parties fired volleys this week over a special legislative session that actually has yet to be called. Mal, let's start with the basic. Who's going to get to call the legislature back in the special session?
Well, a special session can be called two different ways. The legislature can call itself into session. If it does, that procedure is pretty complex. It takes a majority of each of the four party caucuses, two in the House, two in the Senate, in order to come in, call themselves into a session. Now, that's what the Republicans keep talking about. What is far more likely is that the governor, who has the absolute power to call a special session all on her own, will try to reach some sort of agreement on what needs to be done. We have so many unknowns at the moment. One of the reasons there would need to be a special session is if Congress sends out some more money. What they're calling it, what, COVID-5 stimulus relief bill? What's in it? What are the strings attached? Will the money have to be allocated by the governor? Will the money have to be allocated by a legislature? Those are the unknowns at the moment. There is also a number of issues that the Democrats would like to see considered that were kind of left on the table, if you will, when they abruptly adjourned March 17th. The move there is, well, maybe we can get some of these other bills through. Underlying all of this is the fact that if we have an extraordinary special session in August, it'll be less than 2 months before the election, and both parties will make every possible effort to play their hand and try to get support for their candidates by the various votes that would have to be taken.
You know, there's been this release of letters, which is my favorite part of legislative bickering, is when they write letters to one another, but they're really for our consumption in the media. And that's where we are right now. These letters, very much signal what Mal is talking about here, which is that if they are called back, you can expect a lot of partisan posturing, and that's already happening. And that's probably what would define the session in a lot of ways. They're not starting at a point of agreement. You know, when they adjourned back in mid-March, they adjourned, you know, because of the pandemic. It was unanimous support. They gave Governor Mills extra emergency powers. That is not where we are right now. And I think if they were to come back, we're going to see a lot more of that. A, because the pandemic has been politicized and become more partisan, and B, because of the legislative elections that are right around the corner.
Regardless of what kind of agreements in quotation marks, are reached about bills to be discussed in this session, the reality is, under the Constitution, once they're in session, they can take up anything that they want to take up. So they can go in with an agreement with the governor saying, we're just going to deal with these six issues. And then all of a sudden, a bunch of other issues get taken up as well. And that is part of the political process that could really derail things in August and ruin a lot of people's summer vacations.
Well, and the other thing too about it is that one would imagine that certainly the major bills that would come up in a special session will need an emergency adoption, which means they're going to need a two-thirds vote in each house of the legislature, and that will give the minority Republicans some leverage.
It will to an extent, but there's also a strategy that says, depending upon the way Congress writes the bill, they could easily be allocating money later on past 90 days, which gets around that and makes it a majority issue. So there's a lot of parliamentary maneuvering also underway here.
Well, lastly, Republican Paul LePage has gotten a new set of Maine license plates for his Lexus. And Steve, for the record, LePage didn't seem to pay any extra for a specialty plate. He just opted for a regular chickadee plate.
Yeah, I was a little disappointed in the fact that he didn't get a vanity plate as well, because I would love to know what he would actually want.
Well, Mal and Steve, thanks both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's Maine's Political Pulse for this week. A reminder, you can check out our Maine Public's Your Vote 2020 debates and other information about the primary at our website, mainepublic.org. Of course, we'll have coverage of the primary results Tuesday night and Wednesday morning. The Pulse will be updated again next Friday afternoon. You can hear most of it on Weekend Edition Sunday and an excerpt on Monday's Morning Edition. Willis Ryder Arnold is our producer. Music is by Rob Holt. I'm Erwin Gratz.